Hello, I'm Devin Russo, and I'm your host for Intelligentsia on KBOO Community Radio, broadcasting live in Corvallis on 100.7 FM, Hood River 91.9 FM, and Portland 90.7 FM. Intelligentsia, smart radio for smart people. Today on our show, we're going to be talking about internalized racism in the African-American community. Thank you for...
Which month is White History Month? Come on, tell me.
Black History Month, you find
ridiculous.
Why?
You're going to relegate my history to a month?
Oh, come on.
What do you do with yours? Which month is White History Month? Come on, tell me.
I'm Jewish.
Okay. Which month is Jewish History Month?
There isn't one.
Oh. Why not?
Yeah.
Do you want one?
No.
All right. I don't either. I don't want a Black History Month. Black history is American history.
How are we going to get rid of racism and
stop talking about it? I'm going to stop calling you a white man.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask you to stop calling me a black man.
Thank you for joining us today. Our regularly scheduled Thursday show, Metakriyasin, will not be on this evening. My guest today is Kathleen Sadat, longtime human rights advocate here in Portland. She has championed diversity in all its forms for many years. She also works at Cascade AIDS Project as the director of diversity and is co-leading the training of HIV leadership training here in Oregon with a focus on people of color. And we'll be talking about internalized racism in the African-American community. What role has long-term racism played in the shaping of the consciousness of the African-American community? Have the long-term effects of racism produced a rift in the African-American community? These are just some of the questions that we will be exploring on this hour of Intelligentsia. Thank you for joining us, Kathleen Sadat. We are honored to have you as our guest.
Thank you for inviting me, Devin.
The clip that we just heard was an interview with Morgan Freeman on 60 Minutes and his ideas of approaching racism. Do you believe that it is really that easy to just not talk about it? What do we gain and how should we be talking about it?
No, I don't believe it's that easy. What we're talking about is a discussion that has evolved over time. And you can only begin to consider the possibility of not talking about it when things are safe enough to consider that possibility. You have to remember that this is a process. It's not a point in time when racism ends. I mean, the whole joke about having a black president and being a post-racial society is a good example of that, especially when you have racism on the rise in this country. I think we have to talk about it in a different way. And I think we have to include things other than race in the discussion. I think we have to talk about human diversity, and that includes class. Our failure to talk about class leaves us stuck in a place where we begin to see certain groups of people in a definitely stereotypical way. And it's hard to break out of that stereotype unless we can really examine what's going on. One of the things I would say right away is that people think racism and bias and bigotry and prejudice are really simplistic, that all you have to do is quit saying the words or decide in your own head that you no longer hold attitudes that were infused into your psyche from the day you were born. That's a pretty hard thing to get rid of. I mean, you get trained to go to the bathroom, use a knife and fork. It's real hard to get rid of those things. And the ideas of race and differences can be much more subtly inculcated into a child. And there's a lot of pressure for that child to conform to whatever the environment is. And there's a lot of pressure on the child, regardless of color, to accept whatever is being taught in that milieu. African-American children in some situations, not all. I think it's important to remember we are not a monolith. We are not all the same. But in some situations, they are what they learn from the day they're born is that they're not okay.
So quickly, let's go back, because I think that we've heard this a little bit in the media today, that racism is becoming more and more closely connected with the idea of classism, which involves more than just race. Can you go a little bit more into that topic?
Well, I think one of the assumptions is based on that difference. If you're black, you're poor. If you're brown, you're poor. If you are Asian, you may be not poor, but you're better than that. American Indians aren't even thought about most of the time. So there's that association of color, skin color, with poverty, because the history of people has been such that a large number of us have been in poverty for whatever reason, whether it's because we were migrant workers or because we had been slaves and were freed slaves. So I think that's an association that gets made. When we see black lawyers and doctors and teachers, a lot of people think of those people as exceptions. They ignore the W.E.B. Du Bois. They ignore the Zora Neale Hurstons. They ignore a history of a love of intellectual exploration, a history of scientific accomplishments, and black people all belong to a certain class. Not just race, but class. You're poor. The assumption is you didn't know how to use a salad fork. You never had a nice wine.
I have a question concerning that, specifically the Morgan Freeman comment. He's not alone in that commentary. And what I wanted to ask you is, folks that are speaking on behalf of the African-American community, in particular those like Morgan Freeman, do you see him as coming from a privileged position in that he has made it, quote-unquote? He is well off. And therefore, that affects what he is talking about in regard to what's going on in the African-American community. In some way, as far as classism is concerned, he's risen beyond at least that aspect of it. So do you think it's a bit naive in some ways for someone like that to be saying, stop talking about it?
I think that Morgan Freeman, first of all, he's got to be as old as I am or older. So he's seen a lot in his life, and I think he's tired of it all. And my sense is that he was speaking from a personal perspective, not necessarily a political and analytical perspective. I think he's weary of it. He's weary of being the black guy in the room, as opposed to the guy in the room, or Morgan. But it's Morgan Freeman, and he's black. And I think that can be a wearing thing when you've been living it most of your life, and all you want is rest from this relentless pressure, this relentless relentlessly being ostracized from the human race or the mainstream. And some of that may have to do with the fact that he has a lot more latitude now. Certainly his ability to speak about it has to do with his position in society. I think that it must be difficult for him sometimes to be forced to live in those two worlds when he has excelled so well in the other world. And he wants people to stop, just stop. But I perceive it as a personal discussion rather than a really political analysis. Mm-hmm. I think it's too simplistic.
Yeah. Do you see that as being a common thread, even if it's a minority view of African-Americans that are in positions of power, quote-unquote?
I've seen both.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen more than one aspect. I've seen people who basically, I can remember a young man standing up in a meeting once and said, I am tired of being black. Okay, so that's one thing. Then there are people who say, I have succeeded, and I need to take this success and this privilege and use it to ensure that other people won't have to go through the same thing I did. or that people have a greater understanding of what it's like to be in this position. And I think there's probably 1,000 places in between that a person can be. They join a club or they send some money somewhere to try to help alleviate the problems. So some people put their hands on, some people want to back away.
A question on that. Do you, in your opinion, do you feel that African-Americans in these prominent positions that have the freedom that a lot of the rest of us, certainly a lot of people in the African community do not have, do you think that they shy away in some cases, or might be tempted to shy away in some circumstances, to talk about racism in the same in-depth way that we hear from other leaders in the African-American community?
I think that's highly possible. But I don't hear anybody having an in-depth discussion around racism. Let's get real clear there. There's no in-depth. There's a challenge. There's accusations. There's finger-pointing. The most intelligent discussion I heard came from Obama when he did his speech. I don't remember the title of it. It was like For a More Better Nation or something like that.
Yes.
When he talked about Reverend Wright and history. That was the beginning of a conversation in my head. But I don't think that most people are talking about it in depth. I think that if you are comfortable where you are and you are African American, you first have to be willing to make other people uncomfortable if you're going to discuss it. And I think for some people it's not worth it. They go to work, they do their job, they go home. There are other people who have found ways to make people uncomfortable without alienating them. And then there are people who, out of anger or frustration or just being tired of it all, alienate people by raising the issue of race. But that's a one-sided analysis. There are people on the other side of this who don't want to hear anything about race. Oh, don't play the race card. It can't be race because. And there are people on the other side who are willing to listen but are afraid to ask questions. They are willing to try to understand but don't want to go but so far in that conversation. It's a very difficult conversation to have.
So as an expert...
I don't know if I'd call myself an expert.
In Portland, with human rights, the advocacy that you do, would you agree that conflict, nonviolent conflict, including discussion, can be made into a positive endeavor to bring about positive change? So, I mean, you were indicating that sometimes people have to speak out. They have to ruffle some feathers, if I may use my own term, in order to push the envelope. They have to make people feel uncomfortable.
Yes, and they will be uncomfortable, too. Everyone will be uncomfortable. I think the conversation has to happen. And it's conflict, and the difficulty is it's a conflict of emotion more than anything else. It's how you feel. And we haven't learned to talk with each other well about how we feel. We tend to put the responsibility for our feelings on other people. We also haven't learned to talk about history because we don't know enough of it. We don't know all the nuances. We don't know the what drove certain people to do certain things at certain times. We haven't looked at the capsule, the time in which they were living, and how that might have affected the way they did things. We do know that there were good people and bad people all through history. We tend to want to look at history as the events that are brought about by an individual, as opposed to groups of people trying to make their lives meaningful. The conversation that Judith Mowry has been facilitating for the city around gentrification is a first step. To get people together who have differences in opinion and to get them to talk with each other and to try to do that in a way that is emotionally honest but not abusive, not violent, not intended to hurt the other. Doesn't mean the other won't hurt, but that's not the goal. I think they're critical. I think that is the conversation that we are now in a place where we can have that conversation. We've been building up to that conversation for 50 years.
Thank you. Right now, we're going to take a short musical break, and we'll return in just a moment to Intelligentsia on KBOO. Again, I'm Devin Russo, and I'm your host for Intelligentsia on KBOO Community Radio, broadcasting live in Corvallis 100.7 FM, Hood River 91.9 FM, and here in Portland 90.7 FM. We are discussing the topic of internalized racism in the African American community with our guest, Kathleen Sadat. Kathleen, can you tell us what you thought? Can you tell us what you think about the forms that racism takes today and how it affects the youth in the community?
Well, first of all, I have to say that the young people are not growing up in the same world I grew up in. So my view is from being born in 1940 and having lived in Jim Crow eras and having ridden the backs of buses and been in segregated schools. What I believe is happening to young people that I can see, and I can't see them all, but I see some, I think there's more than one thing happening. I think there are some young people for whom race is less of an issue than it's ever been in the history of the country. And they're comfortable going in and out of different communities, talking with different kinds of people. At the same time, I think that there are pockets of young people who are being left to their own devices, whose primary identity is race, and who are not getting enough support and help to see the broader world and where they fit into it. They're being told de facto that they don't fit in it. They don't have a place in it. And they're being told that by the way they're being educated, by the way that is the school system. Not because the school system is saying you are bad people. The school system is acting as though they cannot be successful by not ensuring that they have a good education. So the end result is young people who don't read, young people who do not have enough experience in the broader world to feel comfortable in it, and who resort sometimes to that racial identity as their strong point. And in doing so, create for themselves, because that's their only strong identity, create for themselves a kind of isolation that keeps them from being what is needed now, citizens of the planet.
Do you think... We're talking about the youth now in the African-American community and how they are, how they self-identify more with their race than with any other group. Do you think, you talked about the school system playing a part, do you think that the media, music, do you think that plays a part in shaping the identity of the African-American youth in a positive, a negative way? How does that shape their identity? Because clearly at least in my opinion, you're the expert in this, but how has that changed compared to when you were growing up, compared to what's going on right now today with the way media is affecting the youth?
I don't think your show is long enough, but I'll give it a shot. I think young people are being exploited to make money. The styles, the music are all, and I'm not going to argue about whether rap has a place in the world or hip-hop has a place in the world. That's not the discussion. The discussion for me is, what is the consequence of having these as the images for young people? I don't have any. We grew up singing. We sang at home. We sang in church. We sang with sitting in the backyard. We sang with, you know, clubs at school. Yes, the music was different. We did not sing songs that denigrated ourselves and other people. I'm holding myself up in some kind of way. I want to say there's a whole generation that I know that didn't do that. What is the consequence of daily looking at yourself as a model for a pimp, and to have the entire country somehow begin to model itself on your image of being a pimp? I was just blown away when the Academy Awards award was handed to the song, It's Hard Out There for a Pimp, a few years ago. What does that mean? Not just for African-American youth. What does it mean for youth in this country that they begin to see themselves as exploiters of women, people who don't need to think about work, people who don't need to go to school? I mean, we're talking now about a country where we show up 20-something on a list of countries that how well we were doing in our schools, and this is the direction that we want to go in. Somebody's making money off these young people. The young people are making more money than they ever thought they would, but not as much as somebody else is making off of that image. So we tell our children through those images, this is what you can be. Is this what we want? It's not what I want for my nephews and my nieces. It's not what I want.
In the 70s and prior to this time, the images that we saw of blacks on TV was as the criminal, always the criminal element. From what I've seen, that's changed a little bit. But do you think what's going on in the music scene, you're saying that they're taking this as a part of their identity, and it's not always a positive identity. Do you think that that's actually working against the African-American community because of the way it's being interpreted by other people in the United States?
Yes, but I don't think that's as important as how the young people themselves interpret it. Because anybody can think anything they want about you. It's what you think about yourself that lets you get ahead, whatever that means to you, or lets you get over, whatever that means to you. So, you know, as a people, there have always been people who thought we were not as smart as they were. We were not as committed or able to carry tasks out, to count money. But we did it anyway. So that's the outside looking at you. But inside, you also have to believe in yourself and believe that you're capable of doing those things. And so what I'm asking here is, what is it that we're handing to our children for them to believe in? And I'm not talking about all children, please. I am not talking about all African-American children. I'm talking about the children who seem to be clinging to identification, a constructed identification for them, another stereotype as their primary identification. Where can they go? Where can we help them get to? Is this something we need to do? I don't know what it is. I'm sure that educators and social workers all over this country have some ideas, and I wish they'd sit down and write them down and print a great big book and then make it happen.
So I'm correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm getting from your discussion that the problem of racism, and in this case internalized racism, is not just the problem in the African American community. It's not just a problem of the African American youth. It's a problem that involves all Americans,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and has to be resolved jointly.
Mm-hmm.
So can you give me some ideas of how that would be done?
Dialogue is first step. But first you have to train people how to do the dialogue. And you have to train people how to facilitate the dialogue. And there are lots of people working now in the area of diversity, human diversity, who can do that work. But we're still doing it sort of almost underground in most places. I think private industry has taken it on a little more seriously and pays more for people to do that than a lot of the rest of large private industry, because they see the value of having a workforce that gets along and makes contributions. I think dialogue, I think teaching history, you know, what Morgan Freeman said about not wanting a Black History Month. And I thought, heck, when I was a kid, it was Black History Week. We didn't even get a month. And I think we have to remember why that's there. It didn't just start right now because some Black people wanted a special thing. It was because there was no acknowledgement of Black history. And in order to have that acknowledged, and to teach the children that this was an important thing to be Black, and that there were people who came before them who did things that were positive, made contributions, then you had Black History Week, and it got expanded into a month. There are things I don't like about it, but until the world changes some more, I think you need it. And I think you need, you know, Hispanic Heritage Month, and I think you need American Indian Month. I think you need all of the people who have been kicked out of the mainstream by virtue of not being included need to be able to express themselves and to say, yes, I'm here, I'm still here, I'm struggling for that which is right, and I want to remember the history I've come through. Now, if the history becomes a grudge, we have another problem.
And but
all that you can feel is anger. You can't change the past. There's no reason to be immersed in it in that way. The point in understanding it is to understand it and to find tools to use to help us move forward. My grandmother was emancipated from slavery in Farmington, Missouri. I know that. My great-grandma. I'm sorry. Should I be angry? Well, I don't like it that she was a slave. But to be angry retrospectively is a waste of my energy. What can I take from that? What have I learned that will help me move forward?
Thank you very much. Right now, we are just about 29 minutes after the hour. We're going to take a really short music break here, and we'll be right back.
Trying to wake people up.
we're in a stage now. We can't take much more. With all, we need our men to be fathers. The revolution is in their house, their neighborhood, and then they can fight strongly, clearly, the systemic and the institutional racism.
And we're back. I'm Devin Russo, and I'm your host for Intelligentsia on KBOO Community Radio, broadcasting live in Corvallis, 100.7 FM, Hood River, 91.9 FM, and Portland, 90.7 FM. We're discussing internalized racism in the African-American community with our guest, Kathleen Sadat. We were just listening to three separate clips from Bill Cosby's controversial comments that were made on Meet the Press. Kathleen, would it be fair to acknowledge that the African-American community is not as homogeneous as commonly believed?
Yes. I think that's part of the stereotyping. And I think that dynamic, we're partly responsible for that in the way that we talk about being African-Americans. We don't usually talk about not being a monolith. We just say black people want this and black people want that. And so the outside says, aha, there's a monolith. That's also what keeps white people from seeing successful black people. It is also what keeps black people from seeing successful black people. Because once you've moved out of the realm of poverty, which is a stereotypical view, then you're no longer black. So, yes, I would say that we are as different as any other group you can name. We have black Republicans, we have black gay folks, we have black teachers, and we have black people who are poor. What can you name that we don't have?
So you're saying that would you agree that what Mr. Cosby was saying, do you think it's more complicated and deeper than what he's talking about? He's clearly talking about, at least in this statement, he's talking about two distinct divisions. What you seem to be talking about is there's even more divisions than even that.
My understanding of what he's trying to say is there are people who are not taking care of their children, and they need to get a clue. But he's talking about it as though it's the majority of black people, and I would question that. Okay? I don't think it's simple. I think that is part of the problem. We want everything to be simple. We want to put it in a book and pull the book down and reach page 93, and that's the fix. What it requires is our personal involvement in change. We want to do... I heard a wonderful story some years ago. They were talking about young men who didn't know their fathers. And I think this might have been in Detroit, but I'm not sure, where a group of black men got together and started walking the neighborhood, saying to the young men that were there, we are sorry. We have abandoned you, and we want to come back and help you. I don't know whatever happened to that effort, but I hope it went well. I think some of our children feel not only has the world abandoned them, but the people who should have been closest to them in the world are also gone. And for a lot of them, that's their fathers. Cosby, on the other hand, you know, has an intact family because his wife has let it be intact. I mean, he wasn't necessarily an angel. And I think he's perceived as putting himself, again, as an example. But I also think he can see that there are some things in the way of the success of especially the young people. And a part of that is not having the support of individuals in the community and their parents. I told somebody not long ago that Grace Bumbry, who many people probably don't know, was one of the early black opera singers from St. Louis, Missouri. The church sent her to school. The people in the church collected money. The people in the congregation cared about what happened to her. She went on the Arthur Godfrey show back in the 50s. And as she sang, he cried. And he said, take her out of the competition. We're going to help her. This is a community of people helping people. We need to get some of that back. Some of it circumstance, some of it is mobility, some of it changing times, some of it our self-isolation. And some of it just plain old stinginess, I think.
So we were talking earlier in relation to these comments, what we're talking about right now, that there's been a change in the way some of the youth, we're not going to generalize here, have used race as their sole or their main key identity. And I think that's what Cosby's talking about. Mm-hmm. Correct me what I'm wrong. So can we talk again specifically to what he's talking about, what the solution is to addressing that shift in consciousness between one generation and the next?
Give them something else to see. Give them something else to know. I have this dream where I'd like to see young people have to spend minimum of 6 weeks in another country, preferably one where they cannot get a bath on demand. Give them something else to know. Give them something else to see. If you cannot see any further than the end of the block, then you can't see opportunity. Even when it's brought to you, you don't see it. So the fact that my family, travel quite a bit, not outside the country, inside the country, in the Midwest. We lived in a place where we lived one time where there was an outhouse. That was our main bathroom. We bathed in a tin tub. We lived in places that were, for me, pretty luxurious. We lived all kinds of situations. It teaches you something. We saw different kinds of people. It teaches you something. I went to my first integrated school in Chicago in 1954. It taught me something.
Let's go to that point. What did it teach you? From your experience, what did that teach you when you were growing up? And we're going to use this in comparison to what's happening today.
That there's a wonderful world, that there are all kinds of things I don't know, that there are all kinds of things that are interesting to know, and that there are a lot of wonderful people in the world. That's not to say there aren't bad people, but I got exposed to some pretty wonderful people, some pretty great ideas. I got taken to the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago when I was a teenager. And for a summer, I almost lived in there, just learning. We don't challenge children in the way that I believe I was challenged. We don't challenge all children. Some still get challenged, and they do well. Our expectations were lowered for a lot of black children during the 60s. They were culturally deprived. They were deficient. They were this, they were that. They were victims of racism. I was never allowed to be a victim of racism growing up. I was allowed to be colored, because that's what I was. But a victim? No. And when you tell a child it can't do something, it believes you. You're the adult telling it. When you tell it it can, it can also believe that and give it a try. Give it one heck of a big try. So that's one way to look at what's going on with the young people is, what are we, again, telling them they can and can't do? We limit them. We allow images of them to be portrayed that don't take them anywhere. And we don't expose them to differences in music. I talked with the priest when he was here about classical music, and how it was very hard to get young black people to listen to it because they thought it was being white.
Back to Bill Cosby and others like him. If you had the opportunity to sit down with them and have an open dialogue face to face, pretend you're talking to Bill Cosby or someone, you know, other people that have similar views that have been fortunate enough to have opportunities mm-hmm. that a lot of other folks in the African community may not have had or may not know that are available. What would you say to him?
The first thing I would ask is, how does class play into your analysis of what's going on with young black people? What does the phenomena, how does that affect them? The fact that they are poor. It can't be just color. There has to be something else going on. I would ask how they would change the school system. What kinds of things they would do to the existing structures, or would they start all over again? I had the good fortune to attend a school at some point in time where the classes, college classes, were about 20, 22 people in a class. Wouldn't it be great if our young people, if our, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10, 15, 17-year-olds could be in classes of 20 people with people who love to teach, who could let them, let their minds wander, let them have images that weren't necessarily consistent with what was in the book or what was in the lesson plan. I got in trouble in grade school because I wouldn't outline my pictures when I was going to color them. They wanted you to outline them in black, and I wouldn't do it because I thought it was ugly. So,
I'm trying to remember what I was going to say here. Do you think that there's some resistance on a part of a certain number of youth in the African-American
sure.
community that are resisting, like you were saying, resisting the idea of accepting education in a certain way because they feel it's sacrificing their identity. It's becoming white or it's becoming mainstream,
mm-hmm.
and maybe they're afraid of losing an aspect of who they are.
Yes. I think that's true. I think that we play a part in the dynamic of racism. I think that for some of us, to lose the identity of being a victim would mean that we would have to recreate ourselves. That is scary. That is hard. It is impossible for some people. But it's particularly impossible if you don't have any help in doing it. I don't believe that young people decide, I'm going to be like this or I'm going to be like that, with nothing that shapes that. That we are shaping them from the day they're born. And we tell them, this music is okay, this music is not. Or their peers tell them, this music is okay, this music is not. This way of dressing is okay, this way is not. And they believe it. I think often if I had children, they would have such a hard time now because I would not let them go out of the house with their pants hanging down around the knees. I would not. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not let my daughter go out looking like she was headed for the nearest brothel. I would not. But people say that's the style. That is the style for, and it's not just black kids. That's the style that's pervasive right now. Is that class? I don't know. I don't know that the rich kids are dressing like that or acting like that.
I think this goes beyond, obviously it goes beyond the African community youth. It goes to, at least from what I remember as a teenager, it goes to that question of that feeling of wanting to belong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, the black youth fits into that that stereotype that other youth fit mm-hmm. into in wanting to belong. Would you agree with that statement?
I think so. I think it's also not just the black youth in America. I just ran into a friend who had been, I think he'd been in the East, not China, but somewhere close by. And I asked what it was like with the young people over there. He said they're wearing the saggy pants. I said, oh, I'm sorry. Belonging, being hip, is a part of growing up. But again, what are the images we allow? And I'm not saying that the young people won't go out and do it anyway. But if you can't leave my house with your pants sagging, you'd have to go somewhere else and get them to sag. Then you at least know there's somebody who thinks something different and is going to try to bring you to some place. Now, I'm not against everybody. I mean, okay, you can get upset. I'm talking about saggy pants. I hate them. But there's something to be said about being able to look a certain way if you want a job, if you want to talk to people and be credible, if you want to carry some level of respect that crosses the lines between you and whatever that group is.
And, of course, the challenge is when you're at that age, you're doing everything you can to be unique, right? You're developing your individuality. So you're working against societal conventions.
Yeah, but you're also doing everything you can to belong. So it is a kind of a dichotomous thing that's going on inside the young person. And I'm not saying that you can impose all the rules, but you can give the rules, ask for them to be adhered to, and at least there's somewhere a standard. But without any rules, without any expectations, which is a part of what I see, there are no expectations for your success unless you do this, this, or this, none of which are particularly palatable in things to engage in. There are no expectations for your being able to go to school, get a job, hold a job, count money, raise a family, because you're being presented with images that tell you it's not expected of you. I also think there's another piece to this. Over and over and over again, young black men kill each other more than anybody kills them. And I believe it's because from an early age they are taught they are fodder. They are to be killed or to kill. That must create a tremendous tension within a young person, the release for which might be to kill or to get killed. I don't believe that this goes unnoticed by those young men.
Would you agree that what we're seeing in black-on-black violence, we're hearing about this almost every day in the media, a very sad thing that's going on, I'm sure you'd agree. Do you think that this is a form of internalized racism?
Yes.
That they want to attack one another, whereas folks from earlier generations would use their words mm-hmm. rather than their bodies, and they'd be engaging with the power structure rather than with each other.
I think yes, to some extent. I'd have to modify it, because I'm also looking at what young people are doing on the net and harassing and bullying people and threatening lives and a couple of murders. Violence itself seems to be more okay. I think within the African-American community, there is has been, at least for a long time, standards about relationships that are tighter, that are more difficult. And so when you break the relationship, you have broken something that is very sacred and valuable. I don't think these young men want to kill as much as they feel compelled to kill. I don't think they want to do a lot of stuff as much as they feel that they're supposed to.
Thank you. We're going to take one more music break, and we'll be right back on KBOO Community Radio.
Don't know why I didn't come.
I'm Devin Russo, and I'm the host for Intelligentsia at KBOO Community Radio, broadcasting live in Corvallis 100.7 FM, Hood River 91.9 FM, and Portland 90.7 FM. We've been having a great discussion on internalized racism in the African-American community with our guest today, Kathleen Sadat. And Kathleen, we'd like to kind of tie our loose ends together here with one last question for our show and for our listeners. With regard to African-American youth that we've been focusing on, certainly in the last half of our show today, what are some, and you've answered some of this already before, what are some solid tools that we can use or proactive measures that we can take to begin instilling positive reinforcement in the black community?
Of course, I want to talk about the children who are not doing well, as opposed to just generally black children. Everything ain't broke. I think that's really important. We are presented with the idea that everything is broke, that the children of black parents are broken, all of them. That's the idea that's being infused in the society, and I think we need to challenge that idea. I would start by thinking about the fact that the children, although, as they say in, one of the books I read, the children come through you, but they are not you. They are not yours. What we are as a community and as parents are the people who guide these little beings into being human beings. That is our responsibility. And I think a part of what we need to do is let all these young people know that they are loved. First and foremost, somebody cares about them. Somebody cares that they succeed. Somebody cares when they hurt. One of the things that I believe really needs to happen all over this country is a good hard look at how we're running our educational system. How many different ways do we need to be told that it's broken? How many different times do we need to be told that it's broken? What proof do we need that it's broken except where we end up ranking on scale after scale in terms of ability? I was told by someone the other day that American children are worse, you know, do bad in math and science and all kind of other things, but they excel in confidence. So they are confident that they can do stuff that they can't do. We haven't taught them to do. And it's not them. It's us. So that's another. The other is the dialogue that needs to take place between adults about race, gender, sexual orientation, all of the isms. We need to have a dialogue. We need to have it in our churches, in our synagogues, in our places of worship, in our social clubs. We need to have it in our living rooms. And it needs to be about how we make it better, not about how this group is bad or that group is bad. Or, you know, we also need to elevate the expectations of teachers. When they expect our children to do well, they will do better. But if the expectation is that you're looking at someone who cannot learn, who will not learn because of their race, their ethnicity, then you're ensuring their failure.
I think what connects to a lot of what you're saying is that's important, not just in the African-American community, but in all communities.
Yes.
When you're talking about education, is parental involvement.
Yes.
And I think we've heard a lot in the media that, not in all cases, but we've heard a lot of disappointing news that there's a lot of cases when parents are not directly involved in their child's education, where they're expecting teachers to be, acting as parental figures. And then when the children go home, they're not being supported by their parents in a discussion about issues.
I'm not sure that the parents are able to. See, what we're expecting is people who have not been well parented to be good parents. So that's another thing I would have a look at. How do you bring communities together to help collectively raise the children in the community? When I was born, two grandmothers were there, lots of aunts and uncles, lots of discipline, lots of correcting, lots of encouragement, lots of you can do it. Again, as I said earlier, people are very mobile. They don't have those stable, long-term relationships. They don't have the trust that comes from that, and so they don't want to expose their children, perhaps, to people they don't know. But somewhere, in order to save our children, we have to start talking with each other about what does that. My understanding is the film Waiting for Superman is something that will help to address this issue.
That's all the time we have for tonight. Thank you for joining us. My guest has been Kathleen Sadot, longtime advocate for human rights, leader in Portland. In our talk on internalized racism in the African American community, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me, Devin.
We'd be happy to hear from our listeners on our show tonight. We could be reached on Facebook at Intelligentsia. It's spelled Intelligentsia. I say that because I misspelled it myself a few times. Again, that's Intelligentsia. You can friend us on Facebook and join the conversation. You can also reach us through our email address at intelligentsia.kbu@gmail.com. You have been listening to Intelligentsia Radio on KBOO, Smart Radio for Smart People. I'm Devin Russo, your host for this evening. Our producer is Kurt Lauer. We want to give special thanks to Rebecca Ney, KBOO Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
To KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is now 7 o'clock. Coming up next, it's the discussion of the proposed ballot changes to the KBOO bylaws on this year's KBOO member ballot. Annie Haynes and Chris Merrick will discuss the proposed changes and take your calls.
Good evening. My name is Rebecca Ney. Tonight, in lieu of Hard Knock Radio, we are going to be having a discussion about KBOO's bylaw proposals. This year, there are two proposed changes to our bylaws. So if you are a KBOO member, and you haven't sent your ballot in, I would encourage you to grab your ballot right now and follow along on this discussion tonight. We will be opening the phones a little bit later on. You can call us at 503-231-8187. Again, we're having a discussion about a change to Article 6, Section 5 and Article 6, Section 4 of KBOO's bylaws. Again, my name is Rebecca Ney. Tonight, joining us here to discuss these changes in favor of the changes is Ani Haynes, our volunteer coordinator. Good evening. And Judy Feistel, who serves on the board right now, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And then on discussing some concerns with these changes, joining us is Paula Small and Daniel.
Bless us.
Yes.
It's Greek, Rebecca.
Yes. All right. Thank you. I forgot your last name, Daniel. I meant to ask you before we went on the air, but I digress.
It would have been Papa Fluffy. We shortened it for you.
Thank you. Okay. So let's just go ahead and get started with this discussion. We'll start with Section 4. The existing bylaw regarding board member qualification states that a board member shall be a member of KABU. The new law states that a candidate for the board must have current membership and they cannot be banned from the building. So the first question is, does this bylaw change adequately address how we respond to banned members who want to run for the board? And we'll go ahead and just go clockwise here, starting with Ani.
I also just wanted to clarify, I'm here, my role as the volunteer coordinator is one thing, but I also serve on KABU's personnel committee and have since about 1992. And that is a role I now have as a staff person, but it's actually in the work that I do with the personnel committee that I became familiar with these bylaws and looking at the need for them. So I just wanted to clarify that it's not just a staffer in favor, but my position as a member of the personnel committee. So does this adequately address members that have been banned? Well, I think what we are trying to address, and perhaps this is adequate, I believe it is a step in the right direction, is that once somebody has actually been banned from the organization, and banned is such a weird word, it's kind of like excommunicated or something, we look at actually people who have been suspended or excluded whose ability to come into the station has been restricted for some reason. So the term banned has been thrown around for many, many years, but actually the term that I think is more accurate is somebody who's excluded from the premises. And that can happen either because somebody has had a behavioral issue, in which case they have been deemed to be a harm to the community that is trying to create radio, or that they could be needing to get a handle on some sort of issue, that are preventing them from working cooperatively with people at the moment. And we certainly have had people who have been suspended, then successfully reengage, but during the time that the behavioral issue has not been addressed, to exclude them from the premises has been what this organization does and what any organization does when one is trying to really create a welcoming environment wherein people can get the work done. So to have somebody who's been excluded for reasons of behavior then say they want to serve in a leadership position of that organization, I don't feel serves that organization. That is the crux of the biscuit for this this particular issue. Does that add to say that you cannot be in a leadership position by serving on the board of directors as a person excluded from the premises? Is that adequate to address? My main concern is, in fact, that once you have been excluded for whatever reason, that you do not. You are not able to continue to harm the community and the organization. So I think that it is adequate. I think it's a positive step.
And I'd like to open up a chance for either Daniel or Paula to respond to that.
Well, there's a lot of pretty open-ended terms here, such as harm. I've been here, by the way, for those of you, like, who am I? Okay, I'm a person who's been here at KABU doing a radio show, a member of KABU's community for about 32 years, seen a lot of staff, seen a lot of volunteers, and not a whole lot of reasons to ban someone from the building or to restrict them, except for, as Ani pointed out, combative, violent behavior. I can't think of, and I invite any of you out there to think of a more politically charged environment than a community radio station. I mean, think about that, folks. You've got people that come in here about they're passionate about the issues that and the communities that they are serving. I've seen all kinds of heated arguments here, but when somebody actually, I've only seen this a couple times in the 32 years I've been here, when somebody actually reaches the point where they're, through their anger management issues or whatever, actually couldn't play nice, couldn't get along with others, and were disruptive to that to me is the only time that I can see saying that person can't be here because they're restricting the right of other people to be here. In terms of political differences or in terms of, I mean, harm, it's a difficult issue. And one of the problems that I'm having with, as it's written in my ballot, the rationale for bylaw change, the words harm to KBOO is there like three times. And I am a member of KBOO, and I feel like I'm KBOO and you're KBOO. And I don't feel harmed by some individuals that maybe somebody else. One thing that Ani said when she was talking, when she said well, I don't feel that they could possibly serve as well. It's so open to conjecture. And so I've been sort of dragged in there today because, I mean, like, I just feel like I feel like KBOO should be a place of open access, and I feel like just about anybody should be able to run for the board of directors because guess what? We vote for them. So if they're elected by a vote of the membership, then I think that they should have. I'm a believer that everything evens out. That people that really can't cut it will probably, well, it may get bumpy for a while. But I feel that way about democracy.
And I'd like to open up Judy for a response, and then okay. We'll go to Paula to start with the next question.
All right. Well, one thing is we have a policy in regards to how we have somebody excluded from the station. So it's just not a willy-nilly kind of thing. It was, and with this bylaw change in mind, the board, I don't know if it was at the last board meeting or two board meetings ago, it was the last one, actually. I'm looking at the date. Because we thought that's definitely a fair question, you know, and a fair concern, too. You don't want us for just any old reason to say that somebody's banned and then they can't run for the board. So it's a, you know, runs to two pages. It's policy number 69. Mm-hmm. And it's on the website, too, that people can look at that as well. Under governance, you can check where the policies are. Right before, it must be policy number 68, is our core values. And so that's what a lot of this refers to in regards to how people are treating each other here. We are an organization that, you know, we say that we promote social justice, and I really feel that's very important, even if people disagree with each other, that people treat each other with respect. I think that's really important. So in regards to banning people, there hasn't been that many people banned. I think in the last couple of years, it's probably...
I had sat down with a colleague, actually, and we were trying to suss out, actually, over the last 20 years, and came up with, I believe, a dozen people in a 500-person volunteer community that's got new people coming and going every month. So there's been...
Were the bulk of those
quite
recent?
A few people, no. I would say not the bulk. There has been... And recent meaning the last 5 years. Let me break that down. I think that there have been, three people excluded in the last 5 years, maybe four.
And Paula, I'd like to get you in on this discussion here. Do you have any response to any of the current arguments for this change?
Yes, absolutely. This is Paula Small. And my issue with Article 6, Section 4, the proposed change, is the ambiguity of it.
And that really leads into our second question,
okay.
Actually. So why don't
well,
I just...
Well, I'll address... I'll just really quickly just say that basically the Policy 69 that Judy mentioned is the Volunteer Discipline Code. But in the proposed bylaw change and in the existing one, to be a board member, you do not have to be a volunteer of KVU. You have to be a member, which is not quite the same thing. So while board members would be subject, apparently, to the Volunteer Discipline Code, that's a little vague as well because, again, to be a board member, you just have to be a member of KVU, and anyone can pay their membership and never step foot inside KVU's building. So I guess that's the issue I have regarding the exclusion of a board member from the premises because the people, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the people that we are concerned with is, as far as being excluded from the premises set foot on the premises in a volunteer position, in a volunteer role, and not simply as board members. And so that's my issue.
So I'll ask you this question, and we'll go to Ani for a response. Is there any language in KVU's current bylaws that specify procedures regarding banning or excluding members, or however we want to word it, from the station? Is there any procedure that specifies that? If not, how does the current proposal define who can or cannot be banned from the station? Paula?
That's my concern. My concern is that while both Ani and Judy are correct that the rationale is we want to make sure that KVU remains a peaceful place for all volunteers and members and the community when you're in the building. It does not really say, there's no statement here that there is a definition of what's abuse. And there's, I mean, everyone can determine abuse. It is somewhat subjective. Verbal abuse, emotional abuse are rather subjective. And it's the subjectivity that is a concern for me. Also, in the proposed change, there isn't a stipulation as far as what it takes to be reinstated, what it means to be reinstated. Is there some difference between being excluded, now being reinstated, having not been? There are too many what ifs for me to be really firm that this change is that much better than the existing bylaw.
Ani.
I have always been really concerned about people being excluded for capricious reasons of dissent. I'm a very proud participant in grassroots radio network, very loosely affiliated group of idealized radio stations that take the social change aspect of community radio very seriously and are very committed to being inclusive and being open, transparent, and engaging. And we've done a lot of work, actually, over the last 5 years here at KVU around actually enforcing house rules, which was something that I'm really proud of working on. It's something that's an idea that started as a volunteer-driven project in the early aughts, about 2003. 75 volunteers came together and drew up the ideas that the house rules were based on that have been finally approved by the board after, 7 years. They're now officially adopted and codified. And that actually caught the attention of many other community stations. We've been invited to present at Grassroots Radio Conference Network things and NFCB conferences on trying to change the culture within community radio to be more cooperative, not to meld into, a non-radical pablum, but to engage our creative passions in a way that we help and support each other and move things forward. And so that's always been a real concern. There are stations, obviously, the Pacifica situation is dreadful. And I know myself, many people were active during that time. Daniel was very active during that time, to not only help Pacifica, but to look at what we do here and make sure that that is never going to fly. And so we did draft and pass the Volunteer Discipline Code. Again, members banned from the station. The only reason anyone has been banned from the station is behavioral issues. And as Daniel said, generally violent behavior that cannot work in a capacity with others. There is one other situation right now that is actually illegal, harmful to the station. That would be a nonviolent behavioral issue, but under legal advice. So with that, we have, is Volunteer Discipline Code Policy 69, inability to work within those guidelines and boundaries as established by staff departments policy, including the house rules. Problems in this category and their effects may vary in severity. Staff have some flexibility in responding. If an issue becomes apparent with somebody's behavior, myself or another department coordinator engages the volunteer and assesses the situation. If it's appropriate, the conflict resolution policy, which encourages mediation and cooperative solution building, is engaged. If there's a second event with that same volunteer, then, again, there's action and maybe a need to reinforce guidelines and boundaries, maybe restricting access to KBOO after hours, separating volunteers, having work plans, and that sort of thing. There's a third event, then there's progressive disciplinary procedures that may end in suspension or exclusion. Now, suspension, people who have been under suspension, and this does happen periodically, can seek to reengage the station following a plan designed to address specific behavioral concerns after and then have a probationary period for reengagement. This happened a couple of years ago when there was a longtime and well-beloved volunteer who had issues with substance abuse and who became violent unpredictably one afternoon, and my God, check this out. You can't be here anymore. You've got to get this under control. And successful plan for reengagement was completed. And he's back, and it's all, you know, it's a good thing. Other people have not been able to go on with that that path to reengage, to deal with those issues, have been unable or unwilling. And so for those people, then, that suspension continues indefinitely. For serious infractions of the house rules, in the event of a serious infraction which jeopardizes immediate safety of the station and or individuals, myself or any other staff present may act unilaterally to suspend the volunteer at once to restore safety. Then, you know, an investigation is conducted. Anyone who is, in fact, excluded, you know, by this time may appeal that to a conflict resolution committee pursuant to our conflict resolution policy. So I just wanted to throw out there that we have actually spelled out very specifically why somebody ends up in suspension or exclusion. And a process to reengage.
Daniel, your response?
Yeah, I've never known anybody to be banned for life, and that it's
not
nice.
Since 92.
It's nice to know that that the door was still open for if people want to come back and try and reengage.
Yeah, very important.
So does reference to this policy, because right now we've got a volunteer policy, if I'm understanding correctly, and then we've got a bylaw. Two completely separate things. To add clarity to this, would you two feel more comfort? Paula, I'm talking to Paula. And
well, I think Paula really nailed it a few minutes ago in a way that it hadn't really hit me. There's two situations here. There's the house rules about how we make radio and how we interact in the building, and then there's serving on the KBOO board of directors.
Absolutely, because just to let everyone know, as a KBOO board member, each member is a guardian of KBOO, whereas you can volunteer at KBOO and have your own purpose and your own standing. Being a KBOO board member is very serious business and should be dealt with seriously. But again, that's where I go back to this issue that I have, because One of the redresses we have in society is the legal system. And the legal harm is also an issue for me. I mean, I can almost understand the abusive behavior thing because, again, if someone's deemed a threat, I can't really say that person isn't threatening or was threatening or wasn't threatening and what the situation was. But a legal redress, I'd have to know the specifics, honestly, because if I went through some sort of legal claim on behalf of someone who may have felt threatened or some other sort of action, I would then be at risk of being excluded from running on the board, even though my role may not have actually been as the plaintiff or the main litigant. I guess for me, again, it's the ambiguity in the whole system.
Would you see yourself as against KBOO if you were in that position?
I wouldn't. Because again, if I'm making a legal claim, or if I'm working with someone as an advocate who's making a legal claim to strengthen KBOO, if that's what our intent is, because that's what all of this is, it's about intent, right? And if that's my intent, I don't know that I feel comfortable with someone excluding me from doing better for KBOO, or better in the name of KBOO, or something along those lines.
So how would we create some kind of oversight to ensure, okay, this person may have some good intentions, but there are also people that interpret this as harm to KBOO? We have a volunteer policy that does specifically state that there are things that I think most reasonable people would agree on, that, you know, it may not be good to have these people around. But Judy, we haven't heard from you in a while. How can we govern this? How can we nail this down specifically to address their concerns, as well as you know, keep the station in harmony, keep everybody happy, so to speak?
Well, I think, you know, one of the major things is that it's not a permanent ban.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, Paul, if you were involved with something that you decided in your heart, you know, that you needed to do in terms of suing the station, and the station's lawyer is saying, well, you can't be in our station now. Well, when it's over, then you'll be talking to Ani and work on reengagement. No problem. Run for the board. Be on the board. I mean, there's no issue with that. And I do want to allude to something that Daniel said earlier, that, you know, as great as it is that our members are voting for our, you know, the candidates for being seated on the board, you know, most people don't know who these people are. We just collect a statement from these people. They say whatever they want to say.
It's like in the state elections.
Exactly. But there's probably, it's exactly the same thing. And that, but in terms of, I think that I think it's pretty much the same thing. Pretty much. But just in terms of KBOO, it's been very hurtful to KBOO. You know, we've suffered a lot in regards to several people who have had lawsuits, have hurt people in behaviorally in regards to how they've been treating people. People have left the board because of treatment by some people who haven't followed house rules. And it has really weakened our organization. So that's the reality that we're dealing with. And we're a small, small little group here, and we can maybe help protect ourselves a little bit. You know, the state, you know, I don't know what to say about the state. You know, that's another thing. Yeah, right, exactly. But maybe we can protect it a little bit more. And one thing I know Ani has shared with me is that when she goes to the grassroots conference, and maybe you should fill in because you know the information is more hearsay from me, that we have one of the most open, open elections in terms of board participants. The most open.
I'm proud
door.
Of that, by the way. I'd like to keep it that way.
I'm totally proud of that, too.
We still do.
And even with these changes, we would still... Most stations, I was totally flabbergasted to find this out, but most community radio stations do not have boards that are entirely member elected.
I know, I've
in
seen
fact,
that.
Some stations have boards that have no membership participation, that are appointed by this group, that group, and the other group. And I think that's an interesting way to set up a community station, and I'm sure that they have their reasons for having done so, but I'm really proud of our open elections. And really, I see this as strengthening the organization, not really putting serious limits on who's going to run.
So really quickly here before we move on, would it alleviate some concerns about this proposal if we were to adapt something that's similar to our volunteer policy, and that was specifically spelled out in a bylaw proposal as to what constitutes you keeping your privileges and responsibilities of being a member and or volunteer and what doesn't, would that strengthen? Do you see that as what Ani would say is strengthening our position? Would that be a possible...
I think it could strengthen and it could weaken in other bigger ways. I mean, I'm just one of these people that feels like when you have troubles in a current situation that you don't go in and change the Constitution. Like, you really have to... I want to acknowledge that it is a struggle. I want to acknowledge that what Judy was saying, that, you know, when people have given their time to come and serve on this board, and then you have some sort of problems with behavior, I acknowledge it's a problem, but I don't think that, well, it's not an easy answer. It's not an easy way out. I'm also very proud of KBOO. I have done, like Ani, I've gone to conferences where people turn around and look at you when you say elected board, and you have a programming committee, and I end up feeling like, wow, we invented this stuff? I mean, no, of course not, but it makes me very proud of what we have at KBOO, and maybe that's why we're still the nation's longest independent radio station. I mean, we are very, very strong. Because of these ideals, I'm one of these people that feels like if something has been working, and I have seen some difficult board situations, and I've seen other difficulties in the building, and I don't feel like we should now rewrite any laws based on a current predicament. And when we talk about hurting KBOO or suing KBOO, I just don't know if someone's taken an action against a decision by a certain board of directors, and I'm sitting in that room as a member of KBOO, it's a difficult one because I don't feel like that person. I feel like that person may be being wronged, and in the courts we may find out that they're right. In which case, why would we blame the victim?
Ani, can you respond in 30 seconds?
Well, I don't know that I can. To that point, I guess I see there's two distinct roles. If you want to engage in legal action against the station, then so be it. Go forth and engage in legal action against the station.
Why is it against the station?
Well, because technically that's the way it's framed in the courts. Okay, I'm just going to go ahead and put it out there. Whether it is or not. But just to say that while you're on the board, you have a fiduciary responsibility to be a custodian or guardian of the station. And I just think that those are two different roles. Once that legal action is over, jump on in again, be a member in full, non-restricted whatnot. You know, that's awesome. That wasn't actually what I wanted to say. What I wanted to say was that I actually really appreciate this conglomeration of people that are sitting here because, in fact, we are really good friends, I got to say. And not all three of us or all four of us all the time and all this stuff. But I have really solid friendships, actually, with the two people I'm debating.
We've all worked together for a long time.
We all know each other. We all trust each other. And we can discuss differences of opinions as people who are grown-ups in an organization who can engage in the diversity of thought. And it's that kind of behavior that strengthens an organization. And I just wanted to throw that out there because I know this dynamic is a little odd but it's okay because this is dynamic participatory democracy in action.
No one's thrown anything.
And we can still love each other and respect each other and disagree with each other. And
I think there's a caller.
Speaking of that, we do have a phone caller. Caller? Yvette, you on the line. Yvette?
Hello, caller, you're there.
Let's move on. We've got one more section to discuss, so we're going to wrap up our discussion on Section 4 of Article 6 of the bylaw, which most of the discussion for the past hour has been revolving around, banning...
It's the big one.
Yeah, that's the big one, banning members from the premise. Our next bylaw...
Well, the bylaw proposal, actually, to just be clear, is around saying that if, in fact, you have been banned from the premises, you are not able to run for the KABU Board of Directors.
And you can't serve on the board.
And that's been the controversy. Listeners, this is going to be one of the reasons why, especially all you members out there, we would love your feedback on this. This is a really important change. And we need feedback from
the
community.
That's important discussion, too. I just want to add that when you get your ballot, you sort of say, okay, it seems like they've figured it all out. And then sometimes we hear these discussions and they go, wait a minute, that's not understood.
Before we move on, we have another caller. Alicia, are you on the phone?
Hi, yes.
Alicia, what's your question?
Hi. Well, I don't have a question. I just wanted to comment, if that's okay.
Great.
In regards to the bylaw change, bylaw number one on the ballot, I support it, and I wanted to comment on the statement that was made just a few moments ago that, you know, why are we changing the Constitution or whatever because of this? Well, there's a thing called precedents. Precedents are set because, you know, there's unforeseen circumstances and things that change and evolve that cause us to, you know, implement these new laws or bylaws to protect ourselves. So I think this makes sense, and that's all I wanted to say is it's a precedent and it needs to be done to protect the station.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate your opinion.
Thanks.
A lot of these things about harm and protection are I just feel like they're open to conjecture, and that, you know, she's certainly, that's her opinion.
So to sum this up, really, you guys are calling for clarification, that you see the spirit behind this, but you
Absolutely.
Want clarification.
Absolutely.
And if I'm understanding over here, you guys feel like there's plenty of clarification already there. Is that correct?
That it's in keeping with the spirit of the organization mm-hmm. to remain open and democratic and radical and open to dissent. But we want people to dissent mm-hmm. while respecting each other, while, you know, not engaging in personal attacks, while not, you know, having some sort of violent outburst. And, you know, we want people to do it as adults in a room. Disagree with each other, kind of like, well, we're doing tonight. It's okay. This is actually participatory democracy.
Actually, Rebecca, I think it's us that feels like it's already there. Mm-hmm. I say don't mess with it. And I think that, again, Paula nailed it when she says we have the legal arena for protection, if we are really talking about that.
That's an expensive arena. I see that it would be better for us to be taking our differences.
It's a protection.
Outside of the arena and within our community as much as possible.
503-231-8187. I just wanted to throw that number out there.
There's this whole other section of the bylaws that we haven't gotten to yet.
I will. And I just want to say just very quickly that my other issue is really that we are taking money from members and then excluding them from the premises, which is one of the perks of community radio, is that you can come down and visit KABU anytime. And I realize that that's not going to be addressed in this bylaw or in this hour, but that's another issue that I have, is that we're restricting people but still taking money. I personally have a problem with that, and I can say in this case.
I do too, actually. The money to me, I resent having my money that I support the station with being spent to protect directors that may be acting wrongly.
Okay.
I don't feel like that's I don't think they're attacking KABU. I think that they're trying to do the right thing.
Both parties have stated your position. I don't think we're going to come to an agreement on this. Or certainly not.
No.
I say vote no on bylaw change.
I say vote yes.
But we do have this other section. Go, moderator, go.
And that's where we're going on this. So Section 5, the existing bylaw states that the election shall be concluded at the annual meeting by a count of ballots returned by mail and cast at the annual meeting. The new proposal specifies that only ballots in an officially signed ballot envelope will be counted if they are returned by mail or cast at the annual meeting. The new proposal also specifies that ballots returned by any other method will not be counted. How is this change important and why? Who will go with...
Again, I say... vote no. Well, listen, I read through both of those as it exists and as it changed. I read it over and over mm-hmm. today when I knew that I was going to have to be dragged in here. And
oh,
I,
kicking and screaming.
I really didn't really want to because I love everybody here. But anyway, I looked at this over and over, and the only the really mm-hmm. distinct thing I noticed was this line about any other methods.
Yes.
Ballots returned by any other methods will not be counted. And I thought, okay, is that the only difference?
Yeah. Well, that, no, well, there's actually, in that particular sentence,
oh.
yeah. The thing there is, it's clarification. This has been driving some folks up a wall for a little while. We provide return envelopes that say, please mail this ballot back to our accountant, who is an independent third party who is entrusted to count the vote fairly, or bring them to the annual meeting. But that does not actually preclude, say, somewhere between one and two dozen members on average every year that I've been on staff, returning their ballots to the station, either dropping them off at the front desk. I found them in my mailbox in the lobby. I've seen them shoved under my door before. And I'm sure that some ballots get lost.
So
this is housekeeping.
Measure.
This is purely about making sure all the people that take the time to vote actually have their ballots counted by getting them back to the accountant or bringing them to the meeting, period.
And the problem is that there have been possibly some missing ballots or votes.
If that there's no accountability. If you, for some reason, decide, bless you, you love KABU, you know that KABU's going to get your ballot to the right place at the right time, and you leave it at the front desk because no one was there, mm. you happen to be here in the evening, you were a guest on a show, and you got a ballot with you, oh, I'm just going to leave it here.
Well, the reason I said no.
Because
we find them. Okay. Maybe...
And I don't want to find them after the vote gets counted and people have lost them.
That's another issue altogether. Because the reason I said no originally is because a few years ago we had a condition very much like this, actually, in which we had a well-written ballot go out, say, look, here's bylaw changes. We want to put these in just and don't worry about it. Just everything's fine. And some people told me, actually, after hearing an on-air discussion, that they had already voted and wanted to change their vote, a handful of people. So I called Mark Eklund, our CPA,
mm-hmm.
and said, what do we do about that? These people actually already sent it in. And he said, if they come here to the office, they can do it, but they have to personally hand me their new ballot. So when I saw that, I thought, that might exclude that.
Hmm. Well, and I also just wanted to say, well, for me, one of the things was, What would be a problem with me, you know, if I didn't get my ballot for some reason, I moved, whatever, now filling it out to the CPA's office with my ID number and signing it just as if it were pre-printed. I guess that's why I had an issue with it, because I thought, well, that could have happened because that almost happened to me this time. And I know I can just show up to the meeting and do that. But in the event that that's not an opportunity for whomever's listening, and whoever wants to actually cast their vote, I just that was my issue with it. Plus the typo that was in there as well, that made me a little
squidgy.
Is it safe to possibly say that this house cleaning change might not cover all circumstances or all situations that might arise regarding a member casting its ballot?
Well, I mean, why have it then?
I honestly couldn't say if this covers every possible potential of a member casting their ballot in some way that. But we think it's.
Because that's your concern, right, Daniel?
Sure.
I mean, I'm not sure I understand.
Well, I'm all for internal controls and for the security. So I have to say I understand why this is here. Without the rationale, I definitely understand why it's here. But I guess that was my issue, was like, if I address it myself with a member ID and sign it, I think that should count.
Hey, we've been talking too much. There's people out there that want to talk.
There are phone callers. Michael is on the line. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I've got one issue with the proposed change on number 5. There is a phrase which, part of a sentence which says, candidates must submit an application, including a statement of interest, at least 7 calendar weeks prior to the election. What that does very neatly is to cut out the right of a candidate to be a write-in candidate, which means that when the candidates are announced, that I reserve the right, I mean, I'm not being personal there, but I can reserve the right to jump in as a writing candidate in order to guarantee an election. There has been at least one case where I personally have done that, because for four slots or for six slots, there were just the right number of candidates and there would not have been an election. And I wrote in, I proposed to write in, and I was given some privileges as a writing candidate. That disappears under the new rule. I'm sorry.
You're moving us along, right there. So we appreciate that. Ani, do you want to respond to that?
The existing bylaw actually reads, that sentence actually reads, candidates may run for election by submitting a statement of interest to be received by the nominating committee or its designee at least 7 calendar weeks prior to the election. That,
already there.
That 7 calendar weeks is actually there because of Oregon state law and other bylaw that states that, you know, you have to mail ballots if other than by first class, no greater than 60, no fewer than 30 days before the annual election. And by the time you actually have to get it to the printing and mailing process, 7 calendar weeks is what it takes to get all of those candidate statements laid out, printed, and mailed so that it meets the 30, no less than 30 day prior to the annual election. So actually that 7 weeks, I just want to be very, very clear, is actually in the existing bylaw. The thing that changes in that sentence is that the candidate must submit an application, including a statement of interest to the nominating committee or its designee. The submitting of an application, including a statement of interest to the nominating committee, is the change.
Caller, you're on the line. Dave, are you on the line?
Hi, Dave.
Hello?
Is that Dave? That's Yvette.
Hi, Yvette. How are you?
Hey.
All right, what's your question or comment?
I just have to say that I am banished, and included in my banishment letter was the fact that I had joked about Becky Chow. In my joking, I said she must be a member of the CIA. That was a reason for banishing me, and I also wanted to add that the group of the banished people who were banished outside of any known policy, we knew about Becky Chow's Nazi sympathizing like 6 months to a year before it became public. And yet we can't put that kind of stuff on the cable website, et cetera, because it's censored.
Okay.
And no further. And I went, okay, so my...
And we... Yvette, we want to thank you for bringing up your concern.
Actually, to the listeners, we ought to mention that we had an issue of libel and slander that we had to deal with.
So, that's a very long situation there that unfortunately we only have about 7 minutes left.
Still have Dave?
I wanted to mention one other thing that we haven't talked about that is a difference with the new... Section 5 from the existing Section 5, that it says the new one is the Board of Directors shall encourage diverse candidates to run for the board.
That is my final question.
Oh, okay.
Sweet. So
I
wanted
to make sure we didn't overlook that.
Yes.
I wanted to make sure that was out there. The existing one had said that the election... Where that says the Board of Directors shall be responsible for ensuring that an adequate number of candidates representative of the diversity of the corporation members are nominated. We feel that's an ideal. We feel that it's an ideal, but it's nothing that has ever been enforced in any way. It's an ideal that we want to see happen, and I think, you know, this slate of candidates, you know, we hit some of that ideal and some not, and but
it's tough to enforce.
Let me just
without
go ahead.
Ability to draft. you will serve your community radio station.
Well, and what the language specifically says, at least the part that you're bringing up here in this particular bylaw change, is that the board shall be responsible for ensuring the diversity of candidates. That's the old language. versus the new language says the board is going to encourage diverse candidates to run for the board. My question is, how does this proposed bylaw change affect how KBOO will recruit board candidates in the future? Are there, and
doesn't affect.
It doesn't.
No.
Do Paula or Daniel have any response to that?
Yeah, I actually, I think that was an interesting change in language, because it does seem to be, I get that it's an ideal, and that's community radio, because we are community, we want to represent the community. But it does ask, it does beg the question, as people would say, of what are we doing to outreach then to make sure and to ensure. Because I liked the ensure from before. Mm-hmm. I did like that a little bit more, because it seemed a call of action almost. Mm-hmm. And that's been downplayed, I guess, in the revision to me.
I got to say, that was hotly debated at the personnel committee level. And I prefer the ensure language, personally. But that all said, I am persuaded by pragmatism at the end of the day sometimes. And aside from the ability to actually draft people that we think would be great candidates, which, let's face facts, I came close to this time, that it's hard to really find people who have, A, the time, because the board takes an incredible amount of time, passion, and energy, so to serve on the board. I think we always need to really take that responsibility to have a diverse slate of candidates in all aspects of the diversity that is found here at the radio station present. That's going to serve our membership and the station best. But outside of the ability to directly draft a person, we don't have the ability to ensure. And I can't say that something should be in the bylaws that we actually don't have the capacity to uphold.
We have 3 minutes left and one phone caller. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to go back to Section 4, because I've been trying to call for a while and couldn't get on. I'm concerned that there's a history, as you alluded to earlier, of progressive organizations that can sometimes be taken over by rogue or arbitrary managers or cliques on the board,
mm-hmm.
and try to take an organization in a different direction. You mentioned Pacifica Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Antioch University did this a couple years ago and closed down an entire college campus. I can think of other nonprofits that did this. And KBOO had a manager in the 1970s who was acting in what some people thought was an arbitrary manner. So
I've heard about him. We've had a couple since then, too.
Yeah, hypothetically, in that case, there was a rebellion among volunteers, and they organized and tried to, what they did was they thought they were reclaiming the station. So what happens if you get another manager who wants to take the station in a different direction, and there's some people who want to run for the board and oppose that, and then he bans them? A manager can ban these people, their political opponents. It just seems like this is a very poorly thought-out wording with, well, you're not even putting the procedures for banning in the same bylaws, which is
and that
highly
is
irregular.
Definitely something that we spent a good 40 to 45 minutes hashing over, and that is one of the top concerns about that bylaw.
That's a really good point.
Thank you for your call. Appreciate
that. I think he should sit there.
And I think that is, of course, the danger, always. Capricious, rogue elements, yeah, that's always a danger. And I've always had the greatest of faith in the KBOO volunteer community and the KBOO membership to actually make some noise, come down, get involved, start going to meetings, and using the processes that we have to make such an outcry that these things have never prevailed. And in my involvement in the last 20 years, I've seen at least a couple, three maybe, really good attempts to restrict the station in any of a number of ways to take us in some other direction. And I have seen a joyful noise being made to keep us boisterous, to keep us very independent and very eclectic.
Don't you still have faith, Ani?
I do still have faith. And I've also seen some people, well, who have done some incredible things.
Yes.
Not really cop to it and attempt to be in leadership positions.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean incredible things, not in the good way.
Hey, Ani.
I'll leave it there.
Question.
Judy, yes.
In regards to that last caller, is how does somebody get banned? Can one individual ban a person?
In fact, no. It has to be, we've talked about this substantially, the staff, there has to be a majority decision of the staff. And in fact, in case of exclusion, I believe it's consensus of the staff. So it's not a rogue manager, and really we've never really had a staff where everyone is in that kind of agreement.
But I agree
before.
With the caller. I think that the language in this is really problematic, and it's so open to conjecture.
And so
and I'm against it, too.
That we're going to wrap up our discussion of Article 6, Section 4 and 5 of our current bylaw discussion. My name is Rebecca Ney. We've been joined tonight by Ani Haynes and...
That's Judy Feistel.
Judy Feistel.
Over there we have Paul
and Daniel
Flessel.
This is why I have notes that sometimes get buried when I have stage fright. Everybody, we want to thank you for joining us and get your ballots in, examine the issues, examine everything we've talked about tonight, and thank you so much for
and
listening.
See you at the meeting.
And
the
check out the website for the audio from tonight and from the last two nights.
That's A-B-O-O. Right.
So that if you've missed any of this, tonight or Tuesday or Wednesday, already the candidate forum has been posted.
Both the candidate forums have been posted.
Yeah, if you just tuned in, you can catch it on the website.
Okay. We appreciate that. We've got a lot of moderators in the room.
And thanks to the engineer.
To Kurt.
Yeah.
To
Kurt Lowry, ladies
and gentlemen.
Hi, everybody.
Also, to just go ahead and mention very quickly that annual meeting again, Sunday the 19th, 1 to 4, as Judy was saying, Tabor Space. Be there, be there, be there.